I'm Christopher Lydon, with the closest of close readers of poetry, Helen Bendler. In her Harvard office, Helen, they call you the poem's best friend, and the readers too, and we need you in the chilly depths of the great Emily Dickinson, as you have selected her work anew and taken it apart almost syllable by syllable. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We're extending our series, Whose Words These Are, on poets old and new, poets like Emily Dickinson that we only thought we knew. We're talking about the Belle of Amherst, the Hope is a Thing with Feathers favorite poet, Victorian spinster, recluse in Amherst, Massachusetts, who left some 1,800 miniature poems, but almost none of them published in her day. All of this common knowledge, quite useless when we confront a lot of her work. Helen Bendler, thank you for this book. Start by telling us, who is your Emily Dickinson, after all?
My Emily Dickinson was the Dickinson I read when I was a little girl, first of all. She was in anthologies of American poetry, but usually with the worst possible poems chosen, and the most, of course, inoffensive poems. But since I liked anything that rhymed, I memorized a lot of the poems at that time. And it wasn't until 1955, when the first scholarly edition came out, that I learned that I had memorized the poems all wrong, because those first editions of Emily Dickinson, done by Higginson and her relatives, were emended so as to make the poems more innocuous. The grammar
was corrected. Bowdlerized almost.
The bowdlerized, corrected grammar, regulated punctuation instead of her favorite dashes. So that then I had to relearn the poems that I had learned and get them right in 1955. So I've been interested in her for a long time. I finally felt I could teach her a few years ago and offered a freshman seminar and learned a lot more about the poems by teaching them. And then finally I included her in a chapter of a book I wrote lately. The topic was poets' thinking. It seemed to me she showed us thought at its most cryptic, enigmatic, condensed, concise, and often philosophical. So she was a good example of how to show what thought can be as it evolves in a poem.
Where's to begin? When you know, if you were taking five Dickinson poems to a desert island and not coming back, I mean, which would they be?
Well, that's very hard to say. When I was cutting the 1,800 poems to find out, it was originally supposed to be 100 for the selection, I thought, well, I'll just go through and check off the indispensable ones. And then I counted what I had checked off, and it was 400 poems out of the 1,800. So I had many too many. I went through cutting and cutting and cutting. But I would say the ones I'd take to a desert island would be those 400. They seemed to me at the time the indispensable ones. I got down to 150, finally.
And which of them would you read at a dinner party?
Oh, I wouldn't read any of them at a dinner party. It would paralyze the dinner party. Might be a good idea to paralyze the dinner party now and then, but she is so, as you said, chilly, that her greatest poems are ones of the truth, which, as she says in one poem, is bald and cold. And so you don't want to visit a truth that's too bald and too cold on a dinner party. There are charming poems, too. Many of the nature poems are charming ones, but they're also very off-putting often in their sense of the inexorability of nature. I think maybe one of my favorite ones is the one about the Northern Lights, because it was a topic that I've been treated before by Emerson, by Christopher Cranch. And it was a distinctly northern phenomenon, and because she lived in New England, you could see them in those days from time to time here. And because Stevens had written The Auroras of Autumn, I have a particular attachment to that, and because I saw the auroras when I was in Alaska lecturing, and the English department woke me up in the middle of the night and said, come out and see the auroras, and I did. So I have a particular fondness for the cosmic grandeur of that particular natural phenomenon, which shows how far her imagination could reach out to the astronomical distances and yet find a way of writing about them.
Would you show us the Northern Lights through Dickinson's eyes?
Here is Dickinson on the auroras. Of bronze and blaze the north tonight, so adequate it forms, so preconcerted with itself, so distant to alarms, an unconcern so sovereign to universe or me, infects my simple spirit with taints of majesty till I take vaster attitudes and strut upon my stem, disdaining men and oxygen for arrogance of them. My splendors are menagerie, but their competeless show will entertain the centuries when I am, long ago, an island in dishonored grass, whom none but beetles know. She talks of the aurora's beauties and glories as competeless. There's no human act that could possibly compete in glory and effulgence with those radiant auroras. And so she diminishes herself in the end until she is simply a little grave, an island in dishonored grass, whom none but beetles know. She becomes anonymous, gone, dust. She had an alternative, whom none but daisies know, but I prefer beetles myself with the chill that brings, which was her suggested alternative. It's that sort of cosmic reach that I admire in her very much, because, of course, ladies were not encouraged to write about such things. In fact, men were hardly encouraged to write about such things, except in the context of God. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth forth his handwork. But there is no God here. The auroras are self-preconcerted with itself, the sky, so that she moves out of the tamer views of nature, which she had shown in some of her earlier poems, into these very grand poems that will begin, "The heavens were stitched," or to say that she went out beyond circumference, beyond the dip of bell, where no church bell could reach her. She's way out on the edges of the universe. And that daring of her imagination is what her greatest poetic achievement is, I think.
You remind me that, like so many writers, the closer you look at these Dickinson poems, the more you see she's writing about herself, poetry itself, her craft itself. Would you read, for example, that wonderful poem that begins, "Ashes denote that fire was," which again is about her method in a fashion?
It is, and it's the one that, the poem that taught me to read Dickinson. I tend to like, I have liked poems that have a lot of elbow room. Wordsworth, Stevens. Stevens has tiny poems, very much influenced by her, too. But still, it seemed to me she was taking on the grandest subjects and shutting down after only a few lines. And I wondered why she didn't want to expand more in these moments of grandeur. And then I read this poem, which for the first time showed me how to read her. And I was so grateful, finally, to understand it. This is a poem that sees her poetry as the residue of a life, as the ashes might be the residue of someone cremated. And you can't do an autopsy as you would on a whole body. You have to do a chemical analysis, a forensic analysis of the ashes, so that you can find out by going backwards what was the original organic whole of which they are now the reduced part. So it told me that you had to read her poems backward, going from the ashes, the condensed ashes on the page, the consolidated self there, back to the self where the experience occurred, which she represents in the poem first as light, and then the light of intuition or love or anything else turns into fire, and then the fire consumes the creature, and the creature hovers restlessly around for a bit, and then finally is consumed altogether and becomes the ashes. The literary critic here turns into a chemist who analyzes the carbonates in order to find the light and fire from which
so which reading, consume reading them. Becomes science after a fashion.
It does. "Ashes denote that fire was. Revere the grayest pile for the departed creature's sake that hovered there a while. Fire exists the first in light, and then consolidates. Only the chemist can disclose into what carbonates." And I felt that I was being asked to be more intelligent in reading the poems, simply to be able to do the backtracking to the light and the fire that made the blaze, of which this is the residue.
Why would a poet choose, though, to leave just the ashes?
Well,
or pretend that's what she's doing?
You remember that Shelley said in his Defense of Poetry, the mind in creation is like a fading coal. And, of course, Isaiah's lips were touched with the coal fire, and he became prophetic. But can a human being be touched by that fire of inspiration and not be consumed by it? So it's a metaphor with a long history from the Bible and from Shelley, the fading coal.
What does it add to your reading, Helen Dunder, that you studied chemistry in a serious way?
It added to my sense of the possible structures of the world. I love chemical structures. I never knew there were such things until I studied chemistry, everything from the benzene ring on to the formula for sugar, and the way that organic molecules have branches going off in three directions, three dimensions, means that when you learn about organic chemistry, you're forced to envisage all kinds of ravishing structures. And that for me was something that, like hearing poetry for the first time for Emily Dickinson, so that nature is full of patterns. And I've been looking at patterns ever since.
Would you continue with that poem about her letter to the world?
Yes, I'm very fond of this poem because although the diction is terribly simple, it's the simplest poem, perhaps, in ordinary language that she ever wrote. Nonetheless, there are very grand claims in it. The first is that nature herself bequeathed the news of the universe to Emily Dickinson, and Emily Dickinson's duty is now to bequeath it to her countrymen and to have them value her not so much for herself, but for what she has been able to convey to them of nature's news. There's also a distinct feeling of the alienated spirit when she says that the world never wrote to her. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. So she is asking us to be her judges, but to see her tenderly as the messenger of nature. She claims that is the prophetic function that the angels claim when they are the messengers of God, and she is only the vessel by whom nature's news is transmitted, but transmitted to the whole of the United States. So she's not addressing, as she begins, exactly the world, this is my letter to the world, but rather her message is committed to hands of her fellow citizens in the future, hands I cannot see. But she asks that she be judged tenderly. No prophet would ask that. That may be the mark of a prophet who is also a lover of nature and a woman, so that she asks not to be shrunk from the way the populace might shrink from a prophet breathing denunciation, but rather to be welcomed by her countrymen.
Who is that nature that told her the news? Is that Emerson's nature, the God everywhere nature?
Of course, Emerson was immensely important to her. He was the most important intellectual in her reading, in terms of her own contemporary American writers. She did say, if one has Shakespeare, does one need any other book? And that would include Emerson, I suppose. But nonetheless, the secularization of nature, in which Emerson was the American prophet, was for her a deeply welcome idea. She couldn't embrace Christianity. She had refused, unlike all the other girls at Mount Holyoke when she was in the single year of college that she had there, she refused to come forth and embrace Jesus as her Savior. She also, as an adult, never went to church. And she said about the morning prayers which her father conducted that every morning her family prayed to an eclipse, which they call Father. So that her own skepticism is more than evident, and she certainly withdrew from church services, unlike everybody else in Amherst, who dutifully went. And she wrote a famous poem that begins, "Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home." And so,
we'll come back to that, yes. Because she never got over the King James Bible. She never got over talking about or against or with or whatever God or Jesus. I mean, these resurrection, immortality, these are threaded through everything. But before we leave this matter of her method and what she says she's up to, would you read that wonderful poem that I think everybody knows, that begins, "I died for beauty"?
Yes, it's a very interesting poem. She takes the conjunction of beauty and truth not only from Keats, who has his Grecian urn say, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty," and that circular motto, but also from Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who mentions it in a poem about poetry. In this poem, you don't have the Keatsian equation of beauty is truth, truth beauty. It's instead a sibling relationship in which these two ideals lie side by side, but with a wall between them. They can speak to each other, but they cannot embrace, they cannot clasp hands, they cannot do anything but acknowledge their own kinship to each other.
They're in a tomb together.
In adjoining tombs, as she says. "I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. 'For beauty,' I replied, 'and I for truth. Themself are one, we brethren are,' he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names." The end, in which both speakers become anonymous, their names are covered up, which is literally anonymity, means that all culture is limited. Each generation fails, then the pile-up of generations fails, and finally all language and art becomes unintelligible, over the centuries. The artist must face the certainty that she will become unintelligible. She ascribes a masculine gender to truth, he said, which makes us think, at least, that beauty that she fails for might be thought of as being of the feminine gender, which beauty is usually associated with. So that is why they can't be identical. Themself are one, that wonderful use of the plural pronoun and then the singular pronoun, means something like two in one flesh that we think of as marriage, in which two bodies can nonetheless be spiritually, you might say, united, sacramentally united. So she gently corrects him after he has said, "We brethren are," which is a close relation, brother to brother, "and so as kinsmen," she said, "met a knight." And a kinsman is someone of your kindred, is further off than a sibling. So that there's a gentle reminder that these two things are, although sympathetic to each other, are never fusible or fungible or identifiable with each other. And she, of course, holds out for beauty, which is the artist's highest value, just as truth is the philosopher's highest value. And they are shown as congenial, but not the same.
It's so wonderful to hear you put light on these pages. Pivot on truth, though, and look at that other famous opening line, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant."
She is being both, you might say, malicious and also tender in such a poem. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. She casts us as children unable to bear the full light of reality. the kind explanation that eases lightning to the children never tells the children what the lightning can do when it is in its deadliest mode. As she says about the lightning in Amherst, it did not hit her father's house. It just quartered a tree. Well, anything that could, with one stroke can quarter a New England tree is has to be eased to the children with explanation kind, so that the truth itself is dangerous, possibly lethal. And if you want people to believe you, you have to come at it gradually, because actually it will be so far from their own denial of truth that they need it eased, just as Eliot said, humankind cannot bear very much reality, so that the metaphorical indirections, finding directions out, as Hamlet would say, in poetry are a way to persuade the reader to accept finally the dazzlement of deep and chilling truth, mainly the truth of mortality for her. She says, we are molested every day by immortality, but being molested by it was her way of refusing to grant it. The idea tempted her, but she would not acquiesce in the nature in which a believer would acquiesce in it.
She says the truth must dazzle gradually or every man be blind, which suggests, you know, why we cannot look at the face of God. Mm-hmm. But you also make a connection between telling it slant and defending that as a method, and Jesus defending the parable as a way to get the point across.
Yes, she liked parables, of course. Many of her poems seem to be parables of a sort, with a nugget of truth which she wishes to present, but present metaphorically or allegorically. As she says, hope is the thing with feathers. Now, hope has been defined as many things, but never before Emily Dickinson as a thing with feathers. Mm. And she doesn't even say a bird. Later on, she'll call it a bird, but these are certainly slant ways of saying what hope is.
Mm. Yet another poem, I don't think I'd read this before or noticed it before, but it's 1511 in your book, about art and God, the fascinating chill that music leaves. I'd love you to read it and explain it.
Of course, any artist thinks quite a good deal about the other arts and makes comparisons among the sister arts, as she does herself in I Would Not Be a Poet and other such poems, comparing what a sister art can do that poetry cannot. And of all the arts, if you think of Keats with the nightingale, the one that is most attractive to poets is music, because like poetry, it is a temporal art, but it's not restricted to the words in the dictionary the way poetry is. Mm. If any combination of tones can go, and there is no ideational content as such in music. It's a pure syntax of one note following another or one note chiming with another. So when she thinks of the difficulty of writing poetry, which is by necessity tied to the earth and to human language, she, by contrast, defines music, the fascinating chill that music leaves is earth's corroboration of ecstasy's impediment. 'Tis rapture's germination in timid and tumultuous soil, a fine estranging creature, to something upper wooing us, but not to our creator. The irremediably secular and non-ideational form of music gives us an example of perfection of form, realization of a musical idea, termination of an interesting formal evolution, but therefore can stand in for one of the Platonic ideals, beauty, but it cannot, although it woos us to a Platonic heaven, it does not woo us to the heaven of our Creator, the Christian heaven, to something upper wooing us, but not to our Creator.
But it's confirming these two words that I love, ecstasy and rapture. It's telling us something profound about ourselves, but not the creator. I wonder why not.
Well, of course, the highest joy is supposed to be the beatific vision, according to Christianity, when you arrive in heaven, join the company of the blessed, and can see the face of God as you could not in life. We see now through a glass darkly, but then face to face. That is where the ecstatic is supposed to belong. That is where the rapture, now adopted a lot in Christian circles, right, is supposed to belong. She says ecstasy and rapture belong to the arts and not to an afterlife.
And she means it.
She means it, yes.
One more digression about her method and what she thinks art and poetry is about. There's a letter, famous letter to her sponsor, Higginson, in which she says, if I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. In short, it's a violent, absolutely transformative, knockdown, very, very physical event. Did she define success in her own poetry that way?
Well, we just saw her talking about a lightning so dazzling that it can blind you. So, yes is the answer. But there are degrees of feeling that a physical response. The poets have the highest physical response to the combinatorial possibilities of language. The first time anyone who has that sensitivity, that neurological sensitivity, hears a piece of poetry, it must be a whole movement of the brain and of all those neurons towards this light that had previously not shone in the person's universe. Same is often true of highly musical children,
right,
who demand instant supply of this nourishment that they now know they can't get along without. Other people who are tone deaf, or people who are not particularly interested in words except as vehicles of scientific ideas, mathematical ideas, would not have the neurons responding to that. They might respond to the stars and become astronomers or something, but it all depends on what talents, what neurological sensitivities you're born with.
But is she aiming at this kind of revolutionary effect in her poems, do you think?
With degrees, her gamut goes from the very tiny, those beetles, all the way up. There's another poem that begins, "These are the nights that beetles love." So she scrutinizes the beetles, and then she scrutinizes the northern lights. And she had a gamut, you might say, of expression for each, so that there are delicate gamuts of expression for something like the crickets in the grass, and then there are the sublime gamuts of expression for something like the northern lights. But she is never aiming at other than the adequate, as she says about the auroras, the adequate representation of whatever it is. And if it's perfectly adequate, it strikes you like lightning that nobody ever wrote about the crickets before like that. And her sense of the groundedness of poetry in experience, in the timid and tumultuous soul that she talked about in the music, poem about music, is shown by the fact that when she sent the crickets poem to a correspondent, she included a dead cricket in the letter. So here is, and she called the poem "My Cricket." So she, there are two crickets. There's the one from the grass, and there's the one on the page. And she meant the total adequacy of the one to the other, of language to nature. Dickinson inherits the whole Calvinist tradition, and its vocabulary, and its liturgy, and its rituals, and its stances of prostration, supplication, adoration, but she eviscerates it of Christian content. She keeps the words and talks about a word made flesh as poetry, instead of as, in the Gospel of John, the Redeemer. She translates all that sublime diction into a secular equivalent. So just as the priest in the communion rite of the Protestant churches is said to drink the precious blood of the Redeemer, she says he ate and drank the precious words. So it's always the translation into something else. But she had no other intellectual substructure. Later on, people might take on Freud as a psychological structuring of the world, or they might take on Marx as an economic structuring of the world. But she didn't have anybody like that that would structure her world for her.
But this is exactly what I wanted to ask you about. The thread for me in this wonderful book are all the God references. And she sounds very much like a determined atheist in many ways. As you say, she didn't go to church, but that's the least of it. At the same time, she is completely enmeshed in the King James language. And the first poem here is one of many that depend on a religious connection. I wonder if you'd just kind of review a few of these, to me, very tantalizing, mysterious God poems. She is wrestling with the big guy, it seems to me, from beginning to end.
She's wrestling with her society, I would rather say, that insists that she believe in what you just referred to as the big guy, that she thought of, as I said, as an eclipse that the family prayers were addressed to every
capital
morning.
Capital H-E.
But when she baptizes her poems as she sends them into the world, she takes the sacred formula of baptism when Jesus commanded his disciples that they should go forth baptizing all nations in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost in the Gospel of Matthew. She baptizes her poems, but she says, in the name of the bee and of the butterfly and of the breeze, amen. And the amen is there to tell us explicitly that she is drawing the structure from the religious command to baptize all nations into a belief in Jesus and his redemptive function. This is, of course, ushering her poems into the world as newborn children, you might say, being baptized in the elements of nature, bee for being. She often puns on bee and being. The butterfly is, of course, psyche, the soul, too. And the breeze is the breeze of the Holy Spirit. The Spirit bloweth where it listeth. Mm. And so all of these, again, are translations from the religious substructure, you might say, but wittily, playfully, and beautifully lifted into a summer afternoon with a bee and a butterfly and a breeze. And they all alliterate so that they are a trinity. It's, again, a parody in a way of the three equal persons of the Trinity, because since they all have B as their initial sound, which is also the B for being, on which Wallace Stevens also puns from her, I think. All of this is so lightly touched and so sweetly done that you don't think of it at first as a blasphemy, but when you ask if you brought a child to a church to be baptized and they said in the name of the bee and of the butterfly and of the breeze, you would be a little surprised.
You'd know you were at a hippie wedding or something.
Yes, exactly.
And yet she gets very, very formal and serious too. Would you read that poem, Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers?
Yes, sounds it's a wonderful like a poem which she rewrote several times.
Cemetery poem.
Mm-hmm. When she goes to the cemetery, what she sees is all her ancestors. Hmm. And they have been duly buried and are duly awaiting the resurrection because they were all Christians. And they think they're safe because they will be raised on the last day. And they're just in these rather nice underground rooms with rafter of satin, it's the coffin, of course, and more frighteningly, roof of stone. You can't get out of that room. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, sleep the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. She changed sleep to lie. Sleep implies the waking that the promise in the promise of St. Paul, but when she changes it to lie, she makes it final. They do not wake. They are not sleeping. Mm. They have perished. She wrote several second stanzas for that poem, four, in fact, so that what she sets the dead in the cemetery against varies as a context. The first context was a natural one? What is, if they are down there in their roof, under their roofs of stone, what's going on above them? Light laughs the breeze in her castle above them. Babbles the bee to a stolid ear. Pipe the sweet birds in ignorant cadence. Ah, what sagacity perished here. Nature goes on untroubled, laughing, singing, but sagacity has perished, and that's a word, too, from which you can't resurrect anything. The breeze, the bee, and the birds are the same triangle here above you that the bee and the butterfly and the breeze were in the baptismal poem. Then it seemed to her too domestic simply to put the Amherst nature above the graves, and she wrote then a very much grander context for the dead in Amherst. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs and firmaments row. Diadems drop and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. The total meaninglessness of even the greatest worldly events, the diadem of a queen dropping, the doges of Venice surrendering their powers, it makes no difference to the universe or to the dead. The universe goes on as before. Grand go the years, firmaments, worlds all go on as they have always gone on. But to the dead, even the greatest worldly events are soundless. Dots on a disk of snow is one of her most riveting images, partly because snow usually is extended in a wide area, not in a disk, but she circumscribes the whole world as a disk of snow where doges and diadems and whatnot are having their lives and ends. And then these events fall on that disk of snow as raindrops might fall on a patch of snow on the ground, making no noise as the raindrop hits the crystal of the snow surface. It's an event, it's happening, a piece of rain is falling on a piece of snow, but that's the quietest thing she can think of is when that happens. And that's how the dead are deaf to all of life.
The poem, like its meaning, just kind of fades out into nothing.
Mm-hmm. Against the cosmic worlds and firmaments and years, the universe is deeply indifferent in Dickinson, the cosmic universe. Nature she often represents as a tender mother, but the universe itself is very chilly, like the auroras.
Speaking of death, would you read that extraordinary poem that begins "After Great Pain"? Many people's favorite Dickinson, and maybe mine.
This is her poem of what has been referred to by David Porter first as aftermath, that she's a great poet of aftermath, that for her any love is most eloquent when it's a lost love. And any experience becomes really perceptible only when you look at it retrospectively. And to know what loss is, she says, you can only measure loss by the gain that you previously had. They're two sides of the same coin, loss and gain. And this is the great aftermath poem of the hour of lead, as she calls it. So it couldn't be heavier on the spirit. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious, like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore, and yesterday, or centuries before? The feet, mechanical, go round a wooden way of ground or air or aught. Regardless grown, a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered, if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow. first chill, then stupor, then the letting go. She enacts the stages of entering into, again, that rigor mortis, the first chill, then stupor when consciousness begins to fade, then the letting go when you lose consciousness entirely. If you have frozen to death in the snow, you are dead. If you outlive it and you're rescued by the St. Bernard dog that comes with the little rescue barrel around his neck, then when you remember it, there's a blank there. You remember the chill, you remember the stupor, you remember the letting go, but you can't remember the state you were in between the letting go and the being rescued. So that there is a, you might say, a death of consciousness if you outlive a tragedy when you don't really remember who you were when you had been annihilated by it. What is very nice is the idea of what she called the glittering retinue of nerves elsewhere, suddenly forced into this Egyptian immobility where they sit ceremonious like tombs or a quartz contentment like a stone. These are very stone-like conclusions where you can't move beyond them. They interpolate a wall between you and progress forward. So that the feet do not advance, they only, in their mechanical way, go around. It's like the treading of prisoners in an exercise yard where they can just go in the same circles over and over. You're unable to progress spiritually at all when you're in this state of the aftermath of tragedy. And when you think of your suffering, it seems to you the only adequate comparison would be Jesus' crucifixion. And so you wonder, was it he or is it I that have been crucified? And was it yesterday when I experienced it? Or was it centuries before when he died? It's a poem of ultimate claim of suffering with the crucifixion as the image. And it's the formal feeling that comes after great pain is what we would call numbness or anomie, as Eliot called it when he said he lived in a state of perpetual anomia, the inability to feel, of paralysis, emotional paralysis, as I think he speaks of it elsewhere. And what that paralysis feels like when you're still alive, but all your nerves have stopped functioning, and you can make no progress in the ordinary sense but go round and round. You don't even know the ground you're walking on. It's made of wood, or it's made of air, or it's made of anything. And that the dull contentment that a convict must feel going the rounds in that way is, if it's a contentment, it is one that is absolutely frozen and crystallized like quartz, a quartz contentment, like a stone. Again, you can't disturb the crystal lattice in which everything has been fixed as it is in a quartz crystal.
Do we know even now what could have accounted for such pain in this woman's life that she would compare herself, and not trying to be blasphemous in this case, to the suffering of Jesus? Was it he?
Who bore, yes, that bore. Was it he that bore? She had great sympathy for Jesus, and the only part of Christianity she liked was the fact that it had finally succeeded in imagining a God that could suffer, as Jehovah is not conceived of as suffering. But Jesus is defined by his suffering, by his self-sacrifice. And she found it the most eloquent image of human suffering is the crucifixion of Jesus. So it's the one that unites the divine and the human because he suffered as we suffer, and we can see our own crucifixions as analogous to his. It's a bold claim, but everyone who has known the emotional extreme that can drive people to suicide, to madness, knows that it is an extremity of suffering that is really indescribable.
But do you know what hers was?
She thought of it as, I think, the loss of people she loved. It's not certain who the people were. It may be that it was her sister-in-law, whom she adored at first and came then to be estranged from, although they still exchange notes between the two houses. But the After Great Pain poem always reminds me of the poem that begins, "Now I knew I lost her. Not that she was gone, but remoteness traveled on her face and tongue. Alien, though adjoining as a foreign place, traversed she, though pausing, latitudeless place. Elements unaltered, universe the same, but love's transmigration, somehow this had come. Henceforth to remember, nature took the day I had paid so much for. His is penury, not who toils for freedom or for family, but the restitution of idolatry." If you are going to set up an idol, when the idol goes and proves to have the feet of clay that all idols have, the heartbreak that goes along with that was so real to her, whether about a man. We have the famous master letters that were written to some man, presumably, perhaps never posted. But when you're as alone as she, with no one of equal genius to talk to, the glimmerings that this person or that person might be the kindred spirit are then extremely painfully dissipated when the relationship is broken either by distance or by indifference or by some chill of estrangement.
Mm-hmm. People still argue about the love object in Shakespeare's sonnets and in Emily Dickinson's poems. Do we need to know? Will we ever know?
They turn into our own love objects, don't you think, as we read the poems? I mean, they turn into the people about whom we may have felt, "Now I knew I lost her," or any of those other, "The soul selects her own society." It turns into the person that we chose above all others. And so that I think these experiences are transferable enough or universal enough so that the love object becomes the one you felt that way about.
The reader felt that way about, yes.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And then there's that funny poem in which she refers to God as a distant, stately lover. Several jokes at once in that poem. Would you read it?
Yes. This depends on a famous New England poem, "The Courtship of Miles Standish," by Longfellow, which of course she knew. And the legend is that the gruff Captain Miles Standish had fallen in love with Priscilla Mullen, and wanting to woo her, but being afraid to frighten her with his own grim aspect, he sent his young soldier, a young soldier named John Alden, to, as a proxy wooer, asking her to marry Miles Standish. And after John Alden had voiced his invitation for her to marry Miles Standish, she said, "Why don't you speak for yourself, John?" And then ended up marrying John Alden. Rather blasphemously, Dickinson chooses this story as an analogy for God sending Jesus as his proxy down to earth to redeem men. And then God is afraid that the Miles Standish story might be repeated, and people might say, "We don't want you, God, we want Jesus instead." That God triumphs by saying, "Ah, but the Father and I are one," as Jesus said, so that the choice proves out to be a false one, unlike Priscilla's choice. "God," she says very dryly and ironically, "God is a distant, stately lover, woos, as he states us, by his son. Verily, a vicarious courtship, Miles and Priscilla with such an one. But, lest the soul, like fair Priscilla, choose the envoy and spurn the groom, vouches with hyperbolic archness, Miles and John Alden are synonym. The Father and I are one." This is not what you hear preached in churches. God is a distant, stately lover. And what does this stately lover use as a means of locution? He states something. The stately lover states what he's doing, which is wooing us by his son. Then, of course, she uses the word verily that Jesus so often uses in the Gospels, verily, verily, I say unto you. And she adopts that locution of Jesus, verily, she says, a vicarious courtship, and then does the comparison to the courtship of Miles Standish. This is a joke on Longfellow, on the kind of middle-class poetry that Longfellow was writing in the courtship of Miles Standish, which is a charming tale, charmingly told, but not more than that. And then by resorting to language at the end to say that the father and the son are synonym, she sees it as a piece of sleight of hand, of legerdemain, that God is has a hyperbolic archness in saying, oh, but you didn't know, but Jesus and I are one.
But isn't it a joke also about the Trinity, which is always a mystery that us school kids could never quite understand, but that is the mystery of the Trinity, that the three are one.
Yes. She leaves out the Holy Spirit here. So it's
the breeze.
Yes. It's a sort of the breeze is not here.
No breeze that day.
No breeze that day, no. Could we look at the little spider one?
Please.
Because it's a particularly condensed one. A spider sewed at night, she says. And this is probably the tightest little poem she ever wrote. And it is about the spider, whom she had called elsewhere neglected son of genius, and she had taken him by the hand. But that was a more genial and friendly poem, you might say, identifying herself with the spider. But this is the crystalline reduction of art. A spider sewed at night, without a light, upon an arc of white. If rough it was of dame, or shroud of gnome, himself himself in form. Of immortality, his strategy was physiognomy. A very difficult poem when you first read it, because spiders don't sew in the first place, they spin. But this is a seamster spider, and only the spider himself knows what he is up to in his creation. We can't tell whether he was making a ruff for a woman's dress or whether he was making a shroud for a gnome, the first being realistic, if rough it was of dame, the second being fantastic, a shroud of a gnome. But only he knows. He's the one who informs himself what he's up to. He's not doing it for us. And then his strategy of immortality, the way he will last forever, is by the thing he sows. He will die, but his face, his spirit, which is present in the surface he has created, is his strategy for immortality. It's a surface immortality, not of the inner life, not of the inner soul, not of the redeemed selfhood, but merely physiognomy. It's about the driest word you could use for the radiant surface of a work of art from which you can intuit its creator. The art is sometimes very ordinary, like a genre scene, a rough of dame. Otherwise, it's fantastic, like a fairy tale, where in Mercutio's tale of Queen Mab, in Romeo and Juliet, all the fantastic appurtenances that belong to the little gnomes. Maybe he's making a shroud of a gnome. But only he knows his purpose, only he knows his intent, only he knows what the product will be. He leaves the product behind to show us the remarkable surface produced by his invention and imagination.
Mm.
And labor. He had to sew all night without a light. Upon an arc of white. And the triple rhymes, of course, with these little three-line stanzas that rhyme identically, night, light, white, and then dame, gnome, in form, immortality, strategy, physiognomy, are little tight packages. There are three of me, and there are three rhymes of me, and there are three stanzas of me, and each one is different, and the early ones have the nice common diction, a spider sewed at night. But by the time you get to the third platonic level of immortality, his strategy was physiognomy, you are quite out of the realm of ruffs and shrouds and sewing at night. You're into some stratospheric level of abstraction about what art is and what its means can be in It's like a theorem. It's like a Euclidean QED by the end.
Mm.
Very tight.
We're back at the ash in some way, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have the residue.
The mysterious remains.
Mm-hmm, the mysterious remains from which you have to intuit the creator of what you see.
Could I ask you for one more God poem beginning, "I know that he exists"?
Yes, this is the most problematic of the God poems, if to call them that. It's hard to interpret the first line. Many people have taken it as a confession of faith. I know that he exists. Period. She very rarely ends a first line with a period. It's a striking way in her poems to emphasize the tonic note of all that will follow. However, the rest of the poem does not justify calling the first line a statement of faith, I don't think. Somebody has just said to her something like, well, of course, God is the author of your being, the creator of the world. We have faith in his existence. And she is speaking, I think, about the faith of the other person. I know, in your view, he exists. And then she proceeds to give her own view. I know that he exists somewhere in silence. He has hid his rare life from our gross eyes. 'Tis an instanced play. 'Tis a fond ambush, the hiding of God, just to make bliss earn her own surprise when he shows his face to us. But, and the music drops by at least, you know, a whole order of magnitude, but should the play of this ambush and God's hiding and jumping out at us when we die, but should the play prove piercing earnest, should the glee glaze in death's stiff stare, would not the fun look too expensive? Would not the jest have crawled too far? So the glee of the game will glaze in death's stiff stare. And those are three hard beats. Should the glee glaze, two, in death's stiff stare, three. That's where the poem dies, you might say, or imitates what it is to die and become, go into rigor mortis, death's stiff stare. And at that, she says, wouldn't this idea that you have, that God is just playing a game with us, hiding from us now and then jumping out when we die, if it turns out that he's not there when the glee glazes in death's stiff stare, wouldn't this little game that you've been imagining have crawled, a word associated only with serpents, would it not have crawled too far? And she puts the serpent right back in the context of the resurrection, you might say, which turns out to be a cruel joke played on us by God when we wake up and find out there isn't any resurrection and we have become rigidified in death's stiff stare. In that sense, I don't think you can take the first line, "I know that he exists," is anything but a kind of sardonic social comment. I know that he exists somewhere in silence. I mean, she's saying that back to her interlocutor, somewhere. You think you know where it is, maybe. In silence, you think you have heard the word of God, maybe. He has hid his rare life from our gross eyes. Why would a benevolent God do such a thing, she wonders? Why would he jest with us in this fashion? So I don't think it's a confession of faith poem, frankly.
That is a chilling question, and it's a chilling body of work here, Helen Vendler. Emily Dickinson is there as immortal as Walt Whitman, as any writer this country ever produced, and yet she keeps changing, as you said, from your childhood to now. What is she going to mean for 21st century readers, especially young readers, male and female?
I hope they'll see a rounder version of Emily Dickinson, going from the tender poems all the way up to the chilling pictures of death who drills his welcome in, as she says in another poem, like a lobotomy. I don't think that she has been well served by the myths attaching to her, the Belle of Amherst, etc. She was never a belle in any case. And the fact that she was reclusive has not been completely elucidated. The latest suggestion is that she may have been epileptic and she may have withdrawn from college and stayed in because it was considered a shame, of course, to have any such hereditary disease as the falling sickness in the family. But it can't be proved conclusively. But there is a sense of physical frailty that is extreme in the poems, mostly shown in the poems that are usually talked of as poems of nervous breakdown, etc. I felt a funeral in my brain, or I felt a cleaving in my brain. But I think that the physical frailty, she was very small, petite. Higginson remarks on what a tiny figure she is as she comes into the parlor to greet him. All of that is outmatched by a will as strong as steel. And so it's an interesting discrepancy between the gentrified, you might say, Lady of Amherst outside and the chilly but grand mind within. And of course, it made her very impatient with sitting in parlors in her famous poem about the ladies she encountered in parlors, who thought they were above associating with the lower classes, who are also Christian but dismissed by these women. She says, what soft, cherubic creatures these gentle women are. One would as soon assault a plush or violate a star. Such dimity convictions, a horror so refined of freckled human nature, of deity ashamed. It's such a common glory, a fisherman's degree. Redemption, brittle lady, be so ashamed of thee. Now, that's one reason why she didn't leave her house. She would have been in parlors all her life. And she couldn't open her mouth in such a parlor, of course, to express.
I'm just struck also on this reading, Helen, that she had this very absolutely radical, brave imagination, and she had the nerve to put it down. It's clear to me in a different way why she didn't publish these poems, too. This is wildly heterodox. It would have been extremely offensive to many people, but she did it anyway. She wrote them, and the record survives.
She's a great poet because of her copiousness, in part. No matter how many times you've read the whole of the almost 1,800 poems, the next time you go back, you find poems that you have absolutely no recollection of having read before because you just can't keep the 1,800 poems in your head at once.
And if you can do that, Helen Bender, think of us.
Well, copiousness is a great virtue in a poet. Most of the great poets have written quite a lot. Sometimes they were cut off early by early premature death or something, but the ones who lived long wrote a great deal. If you think of Milton or Stevens or Whitman, the ones that lived to write till the end write a great deal, and she wrote a great deal, and to the end, although her production diminished as time went on.
Helen Bender, it is a privilege like none I can think of to hear you take these apart and put her together again for us, and I thank you. It's a great privilege to have you on Open Source again.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the conversation.